Thank you very much, and welcome to my anniversary today. It was a year ago today I was confirmed, so it's been an interesting year. And I'm not going to bore you all with a monologue today. I'll work that in through all the questions as you all go. But I imagine that you all will have something on your mind you'd like to ask me today, and I'm happy to address that, just as Tom described. I'll pick up the phone and say, "This is Sonny. How can I help you?" So it's been a very fascinating year. Love the job. People ask me how I like D.C. I say I love the job. it's unfortunate I couldn't do it from Georgia. But anyway, go after it.
All right. Mr. Nally.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for being with us this year. Thanks for being here. There is the talk of the trade tariffs and the retaliation that might be, and if that, suggesting that you have the authority to use CCC funds or other to help to offset the loss. How much money would be available, and how can you implement to complement the farm programs that we already have?
You know, I appreciate the specificity of the question. I'm not sure it's prudent to lay out the game book for others. Obviously, everyone knows that we have the CCC Charter Authority. I appreciated very much Congress sort of uncuffing us. Some of those funds were limited, and we went to them back in the fall and made the prospect that if something like this came about, we may need to utilize those funds. We haven't made any specific plans, but I think it's wise in these kind of situations, not knowing what's going to happen, to prepare for any eventuality. Now, you remember reading last week when the president had the senators and congressmen from farm states, as well as governors there, there was a hue and cry of trade, not aid, and that's really our first thing. It's also negotiation, not tariffs, would be our first desire as well, and hopefully we can achieve that. The president, I think, has achieved a lot already with his getting China's attention, calling them out over very unfair trade practices in many areas. If you look at the protectionism they have for U.S. ag products and the kind of things they do on an ongoing basis, it's not equivalent to the way we treat their products coming in here, and that's unfortunate. I think he is calling that out. Probably for the first time, we've welcomed China in the WTO, and unfortunately, they haven't played by the rules. So while we have tools at our disposal, I believe the president when he tells me it's whatever it takes. And fortunately, we don't like to predict that. We're hopeful that we can resolve this. You know, the soybean market has rebounded to some degree. Sorghum, with this latest tariff, is not doing well. But overall, the China market actually drove the sorghum premium over corn for the last 3 or 4 years because it was not under TRQ in China, and China and importers could bring in sorghum at the expense of the feed grain corn, and did something I hadn't seen in my career, actually created a premium of sorghum as a feed grain over corn. Typically, it's a 80 to 90% discount to corn. So we're really kind of reversing that because I know when you're a producer, you get used to that premium, and it's been taken away. But we're looking very closely to see, meeting with the sorghum producers specifically right now, watching pork very carefully in that. But we don't want to move too quickly. We don't want to move in a way that would set a precedent of expectation from all producers. Any farmer knows there's market risk. We don't want them. There's enough market risk out there with weather and just general trade markets and different things like that. We don't want them to be the victims of trade dispute market disruptions in that way. And we will look at that and compile that and use what resources we have. We've calculated numbers. I just don't think it's appropriate today to talk about the numbers that our economists have calculated and predicted in that way. Okay.
Ken Roop.
Again, I don't know that it's been chosen as the platform or the debate. You know that the Supplemental Nutrition Program has a title there that has had a work requirement, and I think the committee has just said we want an enforceable work requirement. If you look at Americans and ask them, do you think people who get food stamps should work some 20 hours a week, 80% of them would say yes, Democrats and Republicans. So I don't know that that's been chosen necessarily as the prod here. It's part of the title of the Farm Bill, and they did their job in saying that we believe if someone is entitled to the generosity and the compassion of the American public and the taxpayer, then this ought to be a temporary thing where we help them move from dependency to independent lifestyle. That's better for everyone. It's better for their family. It's better for them, and it's better for the taxpayer and the budget. The expectation, when you look at the graph of unemployment rate versus the people on welfare, it has on food stamps, it has come down some, but not nearly commensurably with the employment rate. What we saw happen is that people, I guess, either gave up as they were down or lost a job, had health issues, which is that's where the supplemental temporary program came into play to help people get back up. People sort of gave up in many ways and stopped looking for a job. The other part of that equation, it doesn't get much attention, but it's it was not really necessarily a cost-saving issue because they moved the money from the food stamp issuance into education and training. And that is the ramp up. In America, we believe we ought to help people up, help lift them up. And many times you can't lift them up a big cliff. You can give them a ramp. And I think the education and training provides the ramp up for those who are able to work. And we're not talking about mothers with small children. We're not talking about disabled. We're not talking about mentally incapacitated people. We're talking about able-bodied people who can and should be working as a matter of an independent lifestyle for their own dignity and for the dignity of their families, as well as the economic benefit of their families. There's statistics out there that show that people that get off of food stamps and get a job are financially much better off than they were when they were dependent on the government food stamps.
Spencer?
Said that he would rather make his profit based on selling the product through trade rather than through a form of government assistance. Another told me that he feels as if he's been plenty patriotic already, and he doesn't feel that he needs to be a great patriot, as the president said, and potentially take some lumps throughout these trade conversations. So my question for you is, how does the administration plan to continue going after trade enforcement and asking folks to be good trading partners at the WTO? How does the administration plan to do that without hurting the American farmer and rancher?
Well, again, I think in the first question, the goal of the president is not to require agricultural producers in this country to be the only soldiers in the battle. We know that there will be some temporary trade disruptions, and I do believe that most farmers, most ranchers, most ag people are patriots. I think they're Americans first. And they understand when China's cheating, somebody needs to call their hand on it. I appreciate the fact this one gentleman said he'd already been a patriot, and I agree with that. But the fact is, he means he doesn't want to suffer alone. I mean, we have risen up as a country many times before, and we'll rise up again. I have to take the president at his word. He's looked me in the eye when I was traveling in the Ohio and Michigan and Kentucky. He said, I want you to tell our farmers out there that I've got their back and we're going to do what it takes in that regard. Now, just like the first question, you don't need to lay out that whole playbook all the way along. And while I mentioned earlier that farmers face enough risk year in and year out as it is, they're willing to assume those risks. That's what they do. They understand that. But when it comes to market disruptions, just like the one fellow that said he would have been a patriot enough, if there are demonstrable trade disruptions and harm based on those issues, I believe that the United States USDA and the president will step up and make those people, I don't know to say whole, I don't know that's their expectation, but they will they will fill in the gaps in that way. And we're looking for those kind of ways to do that. The challenge is, and I've questioned my economists considerably about this, how do you, what are, and they tell me they have the algorithms and the all the models there to determine what the trade disruption damage is based on just the markets up and down. And we'll make that determination at some point in time. And we believe there, first of all, there are regular programs for farmers over PLC and ARC and other types of things that could be utilized. But there are also other authorities such as CCC and Section 32 that could be utilized.
Max.
Mr. Secretary, Max Armstrong from This Week in Agribusiness. Mm-hmm. How concerned are you in this election year that the Farm Bill could get bogged down? And what's the downside risk? We've certainly had extensions in the past.
I hope it's not. Farmers in these kind of environments, the stress that's out there is somewhat cumulative. We've had, the first announcement over TPP. Then we've had NAFTA. And we've had trade disputes, and you've got a year with a farm bill. Farmers, like any business people, they thrive on certainty. And when you don't have a farm bill, that's a lack of certainty. That contributes to the stress. I applaud the House, Chairman Conaway, in getting the bill out. And I believe he will have the votes in the House to pass the bill. We'll see a little different style in the Senate. And I'm hopeful we can get it done. I don't want to contemplate the fact that we have an extension this year. Hopefully politics for November of 18 won't get in the way of getting a farm bill. Typically that's not happened. It's usually one of the more bipartisan bills there. I was disappointed, frankly, that the House Democrats chose to stand on the work requirement issue. I think they've overreached again. If they ask their constituents, both Democrats and Republicans, I think they will get a different message than what they're doing. I hope their tactics are not stalling, hoping for a change of leadership in the House in 18 where they could control more of the issues of the Farm Bill. But there again, the administration and the implementation for an extension is troublesome for FPAC as we administer this across the county. You have to be very nimble, and it takes a while to get the programs out. And when you extend and don't have that certainty, it's very difficult on farmers making plans for the next crop year and what they should do depending on what the Farm Bill looks like. Most of them, and we're trying to encourage farmers to farm for the market and not for the program, but it's not something they can ignore either.
Michelle?
Secretary Perdue, USDA is charged with writing the language for the biotech labeling rule that's expected on July 1st to go into effect. Can you tell us if we're close to seeing that language and give us a little preview of what might be involved with that or included?
Well, I'll try to answer your first question. We're not as close as I'd like. I had insisted last year when I got here that we would meet that deadline. We are somewhat dependent on OMB, on the review process and interagency process. We have turned in our papers on time. The teacher didn't grade them on time. And OMB has taken longer than the statutory limit. We had requested an expedition of that in order to get the public comments. We think we were very close to getting a rule out for public comments. We had many preliminary interagency comments, which help us to refine and massage the rule in a way that we think covers potential objections there. So we think it's very close to going out for public comment, and we will get those back. We have to respond to that and then issue a final rule. So I'm still hoping for this summer, but it does not look like we will meet the deadline that we had insisted upon.
But it will be close to industry intent or congressional intent?
I sure hope so. That's I think that's our job in the executive branch is to implement congressional intent when they pass a law. So best we can, we obviously there's a dichotomy of opinion of that, as you well know, and so that's why we do the proposed rule. That's when we get back, first of all, internal interagency comments, and then propose a final rule with public comments, and then look at that and potentially change what we learn about that, and then issue that to as a final rule.
Rob.
Rob Winters, radio station WOWO, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Yes. Always a treat to visit with you, sir.
Thank you.
High-speed internet really has turned into kind of a big deal for our farm families out there. When the president spoke and kind of promised that he was going to mm-hmm. do something about it, the reaction that I've gotten from some of our farmers is easy to say, hard to do. And a lot are asking, well, easy to say, how are we going to pay for it? How's it going to happen? Anything that you can bring us up to speed on as to where we're at in that process?
Yeah. I think of any kind of issue like this, awareness and conversation is the first step. And that's where we are about that. The there's more momentum about rural broadband, ubiquitous e-connectivity across this country than there's ever been, because I think people are coming to the awareness that it has a transformative ability to really connect. We've got great examples in this country. You know, the Telephony Act that actually preceded the Rural Electrification Act in 34. 36 was REA as we were building out this country. And you know what the connectivity of power and telephone have done. You look back in 56 with Eisenhower and the interstate system, how that logistically has connected this country. Now, what we lack is that 21st century road, which is connectivity. The things that it provides across the country, both urban and rural, obviously are the ability for telemedicine, distance learning, precision agriculture, e-commerce, and just really the sociology of communities. It's difficult now. We know the demographic drain that we see from rural areas to urban areas, and part of that has to do with the amenities that young people are looking for today, and one of those is connectivity. I laugh about it. It's not so much, it's more true than humor, I guess, is that water can go off, power can go off, car can go out, but if the broadband in our house goes out, the kids go wild, you know, that kind of thing. So it's something we've all become dependent on. We walk around here and, you know, you all, particularly in your business, have to be connected all the time. And when you get out in a space where there's no cell coverage, you feel uninformed. And we have that same situation there. Plus the fact there's some gee whiz kind of Dick Tracy sort of things. You're not an age where you know about Dick Tracy, but most of these folks around here would. But there's some gee whiz kind of things out there that on the shelf waiting for the deployment of connectivity. And I've given the example several times about the Farm Progress Show of the sub-inch technology. And you really want to talk about productivity increases. 20 bushels to the acre with 50 to 60% of the fertilizer usage is real. That's real progress. But what does it depend on? Rural broadband. Congress and the omnibus put $600 million in that. It gives us the opportunity here to partner, show how we can leverage that and implement that in ways. I don't want another experiment. We want things that work. That's why we asked Ken Johnson from a co-op in Missouri to come who had done that with no federal help. And we've got some other examples out there we plan to showcase. But I think Congress is watching. We want to have a nationwide strategy with FCC, the Universal Service Fund, Commerce, and all this to actually have a strategy of deployment, not just here and there, much like we've done with earmarking before, but have a nationwide strategy there to do that. So we're looking forward to the challenge. We're making progress, and we'll have applications out and requests for proposals very soon about that process.
This is our last question because the Secretary has to go up to Capitol Hill, and Delaney can have that.
I can tell you what I know. We did this meeting last week with the farm state members of Congress and the governors there. He seems very close to authorizing the E-15 waiver, which would be, I think, very helpful in growing the demand. Our concern is, and I think you'll speak with him later, maybe you want to ask him about the waivers that have been issued here of the RFS that we think are probably over 1 billion gallons. If you remember, the president last fall came in and insisted that the administrator of EPA maintain the 15 billion gallon RVO, which anything less than that demand is somewhat of demand destruction. And hopefully we seem that we have issued some waivers in an amount that gets us below the blend wall, which I think is enough relief for RIN prices in that way. But we're having another meeting in the coming days over that. I would love for the president to go ahead and make a decision. This is not an issue, as you well know, and that's why he sits behind that desk in the Oval Office. It's not a decision that you're going to make everyone happy about. But I think the hardship waivers that have been that people claimed, including PES, got relieved of their many gallons of RINs in their situation, bankruptcy, and others have as well. There's rumors that one company who had earned $1.5 billion last year received waivers as well. And I think that stretches my definition of hardship in that way. So I'm hoping the president will authorize very soon an EVP waiver that will allow us to grow the industry. I think we could. I think it will have a positive effect over reducing RIN prices at the end of the day, and that way in a more transparent market. To some degree, this is as much a big oil, little oil battle as anything else over RIN prices. The blenders are capable of creating the RINs and hoarding them in a way that presses some of their smaller competitors in a way that what happens in a unregulated capitalistic society is that they predate smaller producers, and it makes it very tough on them. Some of them have legitimate issues regarding their inability to be in a place where they could blend and make that investment to do that. It didn't make sense for them. And so they have a legitimate reason. We think if we expand the E-15 waiver, that will put enough RINs in the market to make sure that RIN prices are fairly traded.
This lady over here is
chomping. Well, that we use them for the things that we ordinarily use for food banks and for schools and to buy. The message I've tried to send Section 32 is that some commodity groups have used them repeatedly. And I view Section 32 as when you have a greater than 100% harvest, and then we come in and buy that excess that depresses the market. But for those commodity groups that have a continual overproduction, I'm looking to them to control their supply-demand equation where they don't have to rely on Section 32 on an ongoing basis.
How are discussions going along?
Really good.